You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hi, and welcome to The Compass, the podcast documenting the struggles of life as an artist. I'm Leah Walsh. My guest today is Laura Gratmans. Laura is a wonderful actress, a singer-songwriter, and she was one of my guests at the Compass Live episode at the beginning of November. Sadly, the audio of her interview was messed up and I wasn't able to release it, but she was kind enough to agree to do a full interview now, so even if you were in the audience that night, we cover a lot more ground in this conversation. We did get the audio of her singing her beautiful song, New York City, at the live episode, so if you want to go back and listen to that, the episode was released on November 11th, 2016, and if you listen to the end of the episode, you'll hear that gorgeous song. We went to undergrad at the University of Evansville at different times, and I'm so glad to be getting to know her better now. I have such respect for her thoughtfulness as an artist. So thank you, Laura, for your patience with this process. I will also have a full episode with my husband, actor Frankie J. Alvarez, coming out next week, since his interview at the live episode was cut a little short in the recording as well. So keep an eye out for that. And I hope you enjoy the 59th episode of The Compass. All right, well, let's dive in and we'll get to talk about a lot of things along the way. So, what do you do to try to keep from going to the dark side as an artist?
I think that I get very emotional right away. And then I think I let it surround me, probably. I said this in our first interview, that I think that winter is a really important time of the year for me because I, well, my first winter in New York was definitely the hardest one, but it was the most important one because I really didn't have anywhere to hide. Like, I didn't know what was going on with my career. I didn't know how to navigate my career. I was very much alone in the city. I had wonderful friends, but I didn't really know how to. I feel like when you move to New York, you have to learn how to ask for like a coffee or a drink or
the energy is very, very different from anywhere else.
Yeah, and just, I mean, even from your friends, like it's a muscle that you develop to travel, to get on the subway and go to a friend's house and hang out with them, or to sit down with your roommate and like talk to them in a way that's not roommate talk, you know, where you just A, B, and C. And so, yeah, anyways, the question was, how do I and I think that I'm sure a lot of people have said this, but I think that it is not as much. For me, my personal experience is not going there, but it's walking through it, like finding a way through it, and engaging with it, and trying to understand it more. And in my first winter in the city, I wrote that song New York City, and I wrote it when my roommate was out of town for I think like a month, so I was alone in my apartment, and the heat in our apartment was messed up, and so it was like 95 degrees in the middle of January or something like end of January in our apartment. It was so hot and it was so loud.
The clanking.
And
Frankie's old apartment used to do that. It's freaky.
Yes. And we also had some like vermin problems in our apartment. And so I remember this was like a big turning point for me. Was I remember being in my apartment in the middle of the night, and the exterminators were coming the next day at like 7:30 or 8 o'clock in the morning, and then I had a full day of work the next day, and I was sleeping in my living room, and because my the heater was too loud in my room, and it was so hot, and then this car alarm started going off outside. And so I was like, well, this is my life right now, and that's okay. And in perspective, it's a lot better than a lot of other people's, but this is my life and it doesn't feel super. Anyways, and so that's when I started writing New York City. And I mean, it's one of my favorite pieces, because I feel like it was truly engaged in the reality, you know, in what was there.
Yeah.
At that moment, you know.
Do you find that your music is a tool that really helps you deal with some of the dark side feelings or figure them out?
Yeah, I think so. I don't think that I am a very good writer unless I'm hurting. unless I'm in the middle of that fight. I think that when I've the times where I've landed on work that I think is the most truthful is when I'm experiencing those things or in the middle of some sort of
challenge or
because I don't think that I think I'm a person that needs to be in silence and be in stillness to be able to hear, to be able to listen more clearly. And so when I really find myself rolling down that hill, I think that finding silence and finding stillness, and like whether that's meditation or whether that's just kind of sitting and like lying on my floor and daydreaming, that helps to put things in order a little bit more, and my creative brain starts to turn a little bit.
That's great that you can allow yourself to do that, because I feel like sometimes we feel like we need to be doing something.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I
to be productive instead of just letting your mind do what it needs to do.
Well, somebody said to me one time, a really good friend of mine said to me that she takes like 30 minutes a day of daydreaming time. And she's by far one of the most successful artists that I know, you know, and she takes 30 minutes a day and she just dreams. And I think that that is really, that's really beautiful.
I love that.
And I can be very useful. And I found that that's the time when you're, I almost feel like when you're trying to put things on paper, you're trying to work the problem too early, then you don't allow things to come and go. It's like I find that I latch on to things when I'm really trying to work a problem. I latch on to an idea and like, okay, how can I morph this idea? And okay, oh, now it doesn't work. Like, I'm going to latch onto this idea. How can I work this idea? Like, how can I like mold this into something that's good? But because all of a sudden your critic comes in and you are trying to create something that's good. But I feel like that's the death of creativity.
So if you let it marinate more before you start putting it on paper.
That's my own process, which I have no idea what it is anyways.
When did you, since you went to school for theater, when did you start music as well?
I played piano for like 9 or 10 years when I was starting in elementary school. And then I quit when I got to high school a couple of years in high school because I wanted to do theater, and piano was getting in the way of my theater. Interesting. I never got through a concert or a recital without forgetting my piece entirely or just stopping and walking down to my seat, going to get my book, or messing up and kind of having to go back and go back and go back, and then I finish the piece. And
that's so interesting.
So I had a really bad fear in relation to piano and playing in front of an audience. And I didn't really realize that until I got to graduate school, because I would play by myself a lot through university and through the end of high school. I would find a room alone and play by myself. But once I got to graduate school, we took this class called Actor-Generated Work. And it was taught by Joan McIntosh, who is a lovely actress and director and teacher. Take a sip of my tea. And she was teaching a class that was essentially learning how to deal with the dry periods of your life as an actor.
I think that's so amazing that they have that in the program at Yale.
Yeah. It was one of my favorite classes. It was very powerful. And one of my classmates, Miriam Hyman, she is it's not her band name, but her musician's name is Robin Hood. She's she's an incredible musician now, and her work started in that class as well.
Wow.
And so I decided that from my project for that class that I was going to try to conquer my fear of playing the piano in front of people. And I decided that I wanted to start writing. And I had a couple of...
Sorry, the little boys who are elephants just started playing above our heads.
Oh yeah, that was...
Continue.
Yeah.
I know, oh my
that
god. In the live, yeah, the live episode. This is a running theme in the Compass.
You could soundproof that ceiling.
I know, so. I don't think so either. Well, I think it's just today, since I didn't think about it being a New Year's Day kind of observed.
Right.
So usually if I record during the middle of the day, they're at school. But
So I had a couple of seeds of songs that I was really just had from playing by myself, that every once in a while I would, you know, not read sheet music and start to and so when I was deciding what to bring in for this class, I began working on these pieces, and I was going through a breakup at the time, and I was feeling some anxiety about leaving school. I went straight through from undergrad to graduate school, so it was a big transition, and I knew that I was going to have to make a big transition out of school into the world, and I had no idea how to do that, and I've only recently, I think, landed a little more firmly after 5 years of being in the city. You know, it takes time. And so I brought in a couple of pieces. I taught myself the ukulele, and I feel like I still have the same amount of skill that I did when I started, because I have not expanding my ukulele knowledge. But I taught myself the ukulele, and I brought in a couple pieces on that, and then I brought in a couple pieces on the piano, and that's how it started. And also, I think that my singing voice really started to erupt out of me after I started writing my own music, because I feel like when I was at Evansville, where I went to university with you, but after you. And then for my first couple of years at Yale, I was trying to sing a certain way. I was trying to sing the way that I thought I was supposed to sing. And then as soon as I began making my own music, I thought, oh, no, I sing like I sing. And that was really liberating. And very,
Yeah, that's so exciting.
Yeah, it was really, a beautiful time to realize that the skills that I already had and the body that I had and the voice that I had was useful because it was what I had or something.
Yeah. And to not try to make it fit into some other box.
Yeah.
How did the actual project of getting over the fear that you had associated with music in front of people, how did that go throughout the course of the class?
You know, I don't really remember it being an issue in the class, but once I started being asked to perform, I opened for a couple of bands in New Haven.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I got to the city, I got asked to play at a lot of fundraisers and stuff like that. That's where it really became evident to me that I had to just keep playing through, and I would do something where I would stop and go back a little bit and then play instead of stopping and continuing from the spot that I was at in the mm-hmm. music. And I think that it was really important for me to just learn how to keep going and to make a mistake and keep going.
Do you think it helped also when you started playing your own music? Did that feel different than like when you were playing piano growing up and those recitals would happen? And
yeah, because I guess there was a right and a wrong in that situation. Something that I have learned that is a part of my album, which is very far from anything that's even resembling perfection, it is that the mistakes are a part of the creation.
Yeah.
And that they're not even a mistake, they're just an element of the creation. And so I practice and practice and practice for my concerts, and I practice and practice and practice for the recording of my album, but I still make mistakes. And I make mistakes in the album, and there are a couple of mistakes that we couldn't edit out, and they just had to be there.
Right. But you have an album. Like, think of if you had waited and waited for it to be perfect.
I have all these mistakes on it.
If you had waited for it to be perfect, you never would have made
it,
you know?
It's so true. And I remember at my release party, I made some big mistakes. and musically. And I had this pep talk with myself before I went out on stage, that I was going to allow that to be a part of this night, that I was going to allow that to live. I went to a birthday party a couple of, like, last year, and Stevie Wonder played.
Oh my goodness.
Party. It was incredible. and I was as close to him as I am to you.
Oh my goodness.
And he kept messing up his songs, and he kept singing, I messed up, and I was like, he messes up too.
But he's just having a good time.
And there's something, there's joy, and there's empathy, and there's this deep humanity in that, you know. That's, and it is very satisfying to see a musician or to see an actor or to see an artist, any sort of artist, who is perfect, who, like a musician who plays something perfectly. But then there's something else that you gain from seeing someone who plays fully, but also has a lot of, you know, has mistakes, you know? Maybe it's a little more, but it's easier to identify.
Or connect with them, yeah.
Yeah, with that sort of experience.
Can you talk a little bit about self-producing your album and kind of the things that you learned?
Yeah.
That you weren't expecting.
I learned a lot.
Because I'm sure there are other people who would find that useful information.
Well, I learned that the first thing I learned was that my community is incredible. I was so profoundly humbled by the support that I received. I did a Kickstarter for it. And then I also sought private funding, a smaller percentage of private funding for people that so that I could have like a nice balance between the two. And it was amazing. I mean, I was very nervous about it, but I mean, people that I went to high school with gave to it, people that I went to college with, random people that I didn't I couldn't remember that who they were. Came to it. I was like, this is amazing, you know? And I think that that has to do with the fact, part of that is that when you make theater, people have to come to it to be able to enjoy it. And with the album, it was tangible. It was something that could be sent, mm-hmm. and that they could get it immediately into their iTunes and have it to listen to it. And they could listen to it as many times as they wanted or didn't want to.
Right. That is really cool.
And so that, I think that that makes a difference, that it's compact and that it's tangible, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas theater is so fleeting, and which is part of the beautiful thing about it. But I had done a couple of Kickstarters with my theater company in years before, and so that it was a completely different experience. And also because it was just me,
yeah.
who was asking, who was doing the asking, it was, I think it was a different experience because I wasn't surrounded by other people who were, I mean, Sally Kate Holmes, who was my executive producer, she and my other producers, Ben Quinn and Ben Charles,
mm-hmm.
They, of course, they like put the word out there, but it was my thing that I had to do.
And right.
So anyways, I was very overwhelmed by the incredible community of support that I saw so clearly during that experience. And then I realized very quickly that it was a good thing that I had a lot of people surrounding me that were a lot smarter than me. Yeah. To have Sally Cade, who was I went to high school with.
Oh, really?
I went to Evansville with.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. To have her at the helm with me, just sort of leading the charge. We sat down. She was the first person that I sat down with, and I was like, I had a dream. I want to make help. Let's do it. And she...
It helps when you ask for help and then you feel like, well, now I'm accountable to someone who's helping me.
It's so helpful. And I don't think... Because I had... People had said to me, like some of my good friends, were like, you should put out an album like in the years before. And I was like, nah, no. It's not really something that's inside of me. I don't think I have enough music. I don't think the music is good enough. Like, I would rather not deal with that right now. And then it was like, I woke up one morning and I was like, it's time. We've got to make this happen. And so I met with Sally Cade, and immediately she was holding me accountable, and that was very helpful. And then we brought in Ben Quinn, who was the musical producer.
Okay.
Ben was also an Evansville graduate.
And he had experience already kind of doing that sort of thing?
He had recorded with the Good Morning Nags. They're a wonderful band. And he is just an incredible musician. And I needed somebody who would be strong with me, but also be open to me leading the charge in terms of the music. And he was an incredible orchestrator. Throughout it, he would take some of my songs, like Señor Magnifico, one of the songs on the album. He wrote all of the choir parts. I had an idea of what I wanted, and I had tried it a lot of different times to make sense of what I wanted, and I didn't know how to do it. And so he just took it home and he like wrote the choir parts, and then we had the choir parts. And I was like, hey, that's awesome. But I mean, I learned a lot. I think that I had no idea how complicated recording is. We were given a space, which was incredible.
Oh my goodness!
We weren't given the all of the equipment that we used. So space was generously donated to us by a good friend of mine.
Mm-hmm.
And but then we had to like rent all of the equipment and transport it and bring it up there. And so, I mean, I think that we were able to be in the space as long as we wanted, which was really awesome.
Well, that's, I was going to ask, how many days did you record?
So we recorded over a period of 3 days in the studio. And then I spent one day recording in an apartment afterwards that with the songs that involved the loop station,
mm-hmm.
because we didn't need the piano, we didn't need the sound of the space because they were going directly into a loop station, and then that was being dealt with in the computer. So to have like the resonance in the space was not as important,
mm-hmm.
for those. And we also ran out of time because we were trying to do 13 songs in 3 days. And And I remember our cellist, Paul, when I was originally talking to him about the work, he was like, oh, so we can do like a song a week? And I was like, oh, you're funny, Paul Brantley. And anyways, he rolled with it. It was amazing. That was the other thing, is the generosity of the musicians that came in and helped us. We had a pianist named Noriko Tsunemoto, and she played on one of the songs, and then Paul Brantley played cello. Ben Quinn, the musical producer, played mandolin. Anyways, we had a couple of different
wonderful
people come in. But like Paul, for example, I saw how he worked, and I was like, that's the kind of artist that I want to be, because he recognized what the project was. He saw that it was like a grassroots. I'm talking so much.
Go for it.
So Paul saw what the project was, and he recognized that it was a grassroots piece, and that we had limited resources, limited time, but a lot of very enthusiastic people. And I think he also liked the tunes that we were playing.
Yeah.
And so there was one, you know, he came in for one day and he just rolled with it. And there was this one moment where we didn't have the vocals recorded for a couple of the songs. And so he didn't know, he had listened to the songs, but he didn't know by heart how they moved, like how they,
mm-hmm.
we had rehearsed them together, like he knew all of that, but he didn't, without the words, he didn't know how they moved forward. So he said, well, why don't you conduct me? So I stood on the ground, I kneeled on the ground with the headphones on, and he had his headphones on, and he could see me, and I could see him, and we were both listening to the track on our headphones, and I kind of moved with the music and like used my hands and my shoulders and my arms and my face, and that's how we recorded his pieces.
That's amazing.
And it was so beautiful. I mean, and he came up to me at the release party, and he was like, that was one of my, you know, I really, that was a really special experience for me, because it was so intimate, you know.
Yeah.
And he, even though I was an earlier musician, he was so generous with me. And
that's a special skill, to be able to kind of fit yourself into someone else's,
yes,
vibe or someone else's,
especially
project,
when
you know?
You know a lot more than they do.
Right.
But I think that one of the things that I did somewhat well, I got a little stubborn in certain moments, but I think that I was really good about recognizing the skills of the people around me, which was kind of a beautiful thing about being an amateur musician in that position of creating this thing, was that I didn't feel like my ego was really getting in my way, because I was learning so much so quickly.
Yeah.
As an actor, I feel like I have a little more entitlement.
Yeah.
Because I've trained for it a lot, and I feel confident in my abilities, and I feel more confident in my opinions. And so,
right.
And I think that I expect certain things of the people around me, which I think is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
But also because there was a little more fluidity to my position in this album recording and release, I was able to have this a very pure experience, you know.
Yeah, and really be open to learning from,
yeah,
everyone else.
And of course, I listen to it now, and I'm just like,
that you would do differently now.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many things I would do differently, but it was a really rewarding experience, and continues to be a very humbling experience, because it's there. It is tangible, and it is compact, and it's out there. So I'm like, okay, it's out there.
Yeah, it is so different from theater in that,
yeah.
I mean, I've had that experience a tiny bit with the podcast, of like, oh, someone can be listening to it, and you have no idea.
Yeah.
Somewhere out there.
Yeah.
They're listening to you, and
you know, I've had
don't know.
People people email me that have said, you know, like I...
Like strangers who found it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And or people that heard me play at a fundraiser, right, and they like looked online and like, you know, so it's been an interesting ride. I still don't really know how it's going to continue to unfold, but I'm working, you know, actually I'm not going to talk about this on the air.
Okay.
That's okay.
That's true.
There's something that has to do with an extension of this album, but
awesome.
I'm not going to talk about it.
Sure.
Yeah.
No, but it's so great that you have, besides your acting, that you have another outlet that you can do on your own, that you can express yourself when you're in between plays or in between acting work.
Yeah. There's a part of me that wishes that I had the same amount of abandon with my acting work.
Hmm.
Because I think that there are moments where I have that when I'm doing my acting work, but it's different because it's somebody else's words, somebody else's story. The story can only be told in relation to the other people on stage, which is part of the beautiful thing of acting. And then there's something beautiful about being the single storyteller with maybe other musicians, but like that the words are yours and
Right, and it's your experience. I'm kind of curious about how you deal with auditioning. Have you learned anything in the 5 years since you've been here that has kind of helped you deal with that whole system and how bizarre it is?
Well,
I'm asking for a friend.
Yeah. Well, I've definitely started to notice when I'm giving my power away.
Mm.
So that's something.
That's interesting.
I think I've noticed that the more present I can be throughout the experience, the better. An example is I was auditioning for something at, I don't think it was Ripley Greer, but it was like one of the loud, like Pearl Studios or something. It was like loud and lots of people and it's loud. how do you?
There's some audition for a giant musical down the hallway.
I think I was auditioning for a really awesome play at the time. So I was excited about it, but I was like, oh my gosh, yes. Okay, so I was auditioning for, The Humans.
Mm.
And I was so excited about the play and thought it was amazing. And I had put a lot of pressure on myself, you know, with that sort of a situation.
Right.
And I was so angry at the people who were in this audition space. And then I was like, okay, I'm just going to allow these people into my experience. I'm going to allow them into my preparation. And so I just listened and I heard this little girl singing, it was a song from Sound of Music. It was my favorite things. Is that?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's Sound of Music.
Yeah.
So, but she was like belting it. It's like raindrops on the roof. She was like singing it so loudly. And it was like with an Annie voice. And then I don't feel so bad. It was like so loud. And she kept repeating this like one, like the end of the song or something. And I was like, that girl is ridiculous and amazing. And she's just doing it. And she's going for it in there. And so I was like laughing uncontrollably as I was listening to this. And I brought, you know, then they called me in. And I came in and I like was just like still... dealing with the debris of this like girl who was singing, and they were like, "You ready to start?" And I was like, "Yes, I'm ready to start." And I was like, "I'm sorry. Have you guys been listening to this?
Can you hear that? Yeah."
Girl next door, like, "Yes." She's like, "Oh," and so anyway, so there was this like moment of
just being people,
yeah. You know? And that was, it was such a satisfying thing to just be people. and to see the people in the room as people.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't sound like a big deal, but it is. Those situations can be so formal and weird, and you feel like you have the least power in the room or whatever it might be.
Yeah. But I think I try to, I mean, auditions are like so weird. I think just like trying to be as prepared as possible is always a go-to, but that's for I feel like any actor is like, I'm going to be as prepared as possible.
Yeah.
But yeah, I feel like just like listening, not trying to like do anything, but just kind of like being present.
Yeah.
You know,
It just reminds me, because we're doing Drunkalvania right now with 3 Day Hangover, and it's upstairs at the Russian Samovar, just this very old Russian restaurant in Midtown. And they have live music every night downstairs. And it's like they've tried to do all the soundproofing, but there's just a constant like piano music coming from downstairs, like during the play. And sometimes it helps that it's a Chekhov play and it's kind of appropriate. Sometimes I'll just be in the stairwell about to enter and I'm just start laughing because the song that's playing is like, it's some tragic moment in the play. And the song that's playing downstairs is like a ragtime. I'm just like, this is kind of perfect. And I just laughing about it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I feel like that's useful. I remember, it was Chris Bayes when I was at Yale. He talked about rolling objects and children and animals.
Mm-hmm.
That if you acknowledge them and you allow them to come into the room, like, If a ball starts to roll and none of the actors look at it, then the whole audience
That's the only thing.
Focused on the ball. But if the actors look at it and they like make a joke about it, or they, you know, or they just they acknowledge it somehow, then the audience is okay with entering back into their story because they have invited that into their story. So it's not like a loose cannon that's like, what's it gonna do, you know?
Yeah.
But I think that that's the same with, you know, so much of this, like when you're trying to do your work and the circumstances are out of your control, which is all auditions, then allowing the world to be a part of your world.
Your experience.
Almost necessary.
Yeah, I like that. Can you tell me a little bit about the show you just did in Philly? Were you involved in like creating it, or
I was.
Was it already written, or?
It was already written to a certain extent. So the play is called Jib, or The Child Who Went Forth to Learn What Fear Was.
Mm-hmm.
And the music is written by Amanda Palmer and Jason Webley. I don't know if you know Amanda Palmer's music.
I don't think so.
Yeah, she's married to Neil Gaiman. He's a wonderful writer. Mm-hmm. So the play is essentially about the interconnectivity of a lot of different random people, you know, as one of them is a musician whose career is building, and all of these people are their lives are kind of, they're somehow interwoven, and there's like this energy that's traveling between all of them, and that is ultimately expressed in this woman's music. And she is Jib. She's the lead role. And I played Maris, who is a, I think she's like a music journalist who has a daughter, who is now like an everything journalist, but I think in like her past she was a music journalist, and her daughter is in a coma in the beginning of the play, and essentially her daughter like travels with Jib throughout her career, like during her coma so it's like it's a very complicated storyline, but we all play a lot of different characters, and there's like ghosts, and there's, you know, like a lot of music. It's a rock show. We publicized it as a rock show.
Mm-hmm.
So I played a lot of different instruments, and Brendan Titley, who you know, mm-hmm. he played a lot of different instruments. And so it was a cast of 7 people, and we were performing at the Neighborhood Playhouse, which is in Old City. Is it Old City or Old Town in Philadelphia?
Not sure.
I think it's Old City. The Neighborhood Playhouse is this old, beautiful building that was a church, and then a basketball, it has like a basketball court on the second, or on the third, fourth floor where we were. and we used two floors of the building and moved the audience down halfway through. And yeah, so we're hoping that it'll come to the city.
Why Philly?
We had some opportunities in Philadelphia, and also we didn't want to premiere the show in New York because New York is where young shows go to die.
Well, I have not spent a lot of time in Philly, but I hear it's just a great theater town.
Yeah, it's cool. I mean, we definitely noticed that for a bunch of New York theater makers to come into a town that was not their town, it was a challenge. But by the end, word got out there, and we started to get larger houses. And I mean, they're just lovely people in Philly, and like, it's a booming art scene, incredible museums, and just a lovely place to spend, you know, a month. I was there. We rehearsed in New York, and then we moved to Philadelphia. And yeah, the hope is that it'll come to New York. I think that those wheels are already turning, and we'll see. I'll keep you posted.
Yeah, I would love to see it.
Yeah.
Was it a lot of friends from grad school? Or?
So it was co-produced by my theater company and by another company.
What's your theater company called?
My theater company is called Old Sound Room. And we formed about a year after I left school out of just a bunch of Yale students. And we started with a show called Old Sound Room Lear, where we interviewed octogenarian artists, and we severely cut down the King Lear script, and we inserted some of these interviews that we would do the interviews of these octogenarians, first of all telling the story of Lear, and then also we discussed the responsibility of the young to the old and the old to the young.
That's really cool.
We kind of had that mirrored in throughout our cutting of Lear. And anyways, it was a crazy, you know, like a company's first show, figuring out how to do everything. It was crazy. You know, I was right out of school.
Like, yeah.
But it was really fun. And I mean, I so cherish that time because, again, like that was, you know, to go back to your original question, that I think that like sitting in the darkness of that first winter was really important for me to find my way out, to see out. I think that when things start to go badly, I think that it's easy to turn inward as an artist and as mm-hmm. a person. And I think that like really allowing myself to sit in the silence of winter and the silence of solitude mm-hmm. and of unemployment and
yep.
and you know, it's I think it's a really good thing, and it changed me entirely, and it helped me to see outside of myself once I kind of moved through those initial stages, and I, you know, saw all of these artists that were hungry for the same thing that I was interested in. I saw my interest in this art form that I knew very little about, but I enjoyed, and I felt a very pure expression through it. It helped me to see relationships that I mm-hmm. hadn't seen before, see people that I hadn't seen before, to empathize with people that I hadn't been able to empathize with before. And now I find that I'm developing different skills to where, like, I think that there are different things that are triggers to go to the dark side now. And I'm learning how to better manage those. But I don't think that if I had tried to avoid it in the first place, that I would have learned anything about it.
Yeah.
So at least it's like being defeated by greater and greater foes or something. It's just like not engaging
right.
in the first place, you know.
So what is winter this year going to be like for you? Do you feel like since it was a powerful time for you that first winter in New York, is it something now that you dread, or do you kind of look forward to that regeneration time in the winter.
Yeah, last year I really dreaded it. This year I'm actually kind of excited about it. I think that you know, I'm getting married in July, so mm-hmm. this will be a winter of a lot of planning. But I've also noticed that since I decided to get married, I realized that I needed to, if I'm going to be with my partner for my life, or hopefully my life, that I can't depend on him for everything. And so for some reason this year, I feel very strongly that I need to kind of really dive back into understanding, like, how to engage with myself without, like, depending on other people to help yeah. me do that, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that that was very much my first winter, that I didn't have anybody else that could help me in the way that I felt that I needed it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was kind of forced into that situation. And now, you know, 5 years later, four years later, I'm noticing that that's something I'm yearning for.
Yeah.
I'm yearning for solitude. I'm yearning for space of mind to be able to understand. I mean, I also think that I'm getting a little bit older, so I want to be a little more deliberate with how to move forward. Yeah, I think that this winter is going to be great. I think it's going to be really hard, because it always is, but...
Yeah. No, that's a great perspective to go into it with.
I hope so.
I'm going to take a page from your book.
You never know, right?
Yeah,
like,
you never know.
Things will... Life is a series of surprises. But I definitely think that I feel better equipped to deal with some of those surprises than I did, you know,
yeah.
X amount of years ago. And I think that I remember reading somewhere, I can't remember if I said this to you in our last interview. I love Rilke. I love mm-hmm. Maria Rilke's work. And he writes a lot about the winter. And I was reading somewhere recently, some like study was put out that talked about the importance of the winter for a tree and how the essential, like, microscopic changes that happen during the winter for a tree are what allow it to blossom in the spring.
Right.
And Rilke talks about that all the time
yeah.
in his poetry. He talks so beautifully and poetically about the importance of leaves being stripped from the trees, of the importance of color leaving the world, of the importance of being able to see the sky through
mm-hmm.
through branches that would normally you wouldn't be able to see the sky through before.
Yeah.
Because it gives you it allows you the space to change
yeah.
in ways that when things are like gushing forth, that you don't have the same opportunity. It's not fertile ground. It's a different kind of fertile ground. I honestly think that the most important changes, the most important work is done in the driest and coldest periods of time, which is also, that's why I called my album Hug the Lonely Cactus, because it has to do with growing something fruitful in a seemingly dry and barren landscape.
Yeah.
And that in turn, you know, one like living thing can become a home or a reservoir or shade or water for the living things around it.
Mm-hmm.
That all of a sudden when you're able to like invest in that landscape, then you can become a source for other living things, you know?
I like that. How is it for you, and since your fiancé Ben is an artist as well, how is it for you guys kind of figuring out that relationship when you're both artists?
It's complicated, but it's doable. I think that we both worry about money.
Mm-hmm.
And we both we both wish that we had a situation that was maybe a little more forgiving.
Yeah.
But, I mean, we get creative, you know? I feel like that's the thing that I have, again, that I've started to really think about, is we've prepared to actually, like, you know, we've started to plan for the long haul. And I think we started that early because we knew we wanted to be together, but mm-hmm. now it's a little more tangible. I think that we're going to have to make some sacrifices, honestly.
It's scary, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know any other way to... I don't think that there's a sugar-coated version. I think that it's... I think we're both going to have to sacrifice.
Yeah.
Our artistic lives, part of our, like, you know, portions of our artistic mm-hmm. lives. And also... vice versa, like time with each other for artistic lives. Mm-hmm. And
have you guys done a ton of long distance?
We've done some long distance. We did a couple of months when I was in Dallas, and then we did a couple of months when I was in Rochester, and then he was in Salt Lake City. So we've done long distance. We haven't done like 5 months or 6 months of long distance. My stomach keeps growling.
It's okay.
But I think that will, I feel like we're pretty, we figured out our groove with long distance. And we also go to see each other regularly when we're, as much as we can. But I really think that we're kind of seeing that, I think one of the reasons that we work is that for neither of us, our career is more important than our relationships. And I don't think that it's a bad thing for your art or for your profession to be more important than your relationships. But I do think that it's important to know that about yourself. And so for us, I think our relationships take precedent.
Yeah.
And so the fact that we both understand that, I think will do us a lot of good. And I think we're both ambitious people. We really mm-hmm. want to be artists in the world, and I really want to be an actor, mm-hmm. a working actor in the world. And when I am, it's amazing. And when I'm not, it sucks.
Yep.
But I also think, like, I need to take ownership of that decision, that mm-hmm. that's what I want to do. And also, I'm not going to sacrifice my, you know, I'm not going to, we're both, I think the fact that we're both artists actually helps with the long distance, or with the...
No, you understand how important it is to the other person.
Yes, and because we both understand that you have to make sacrifices for each other and for the work,
mm-hmm.
that works in our favor.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, it's hard. It's really hard. Like,
do you think that you guys will stay in New York long term? How are you feeling about the city right now?
Well, our apartment rocks. Yeah. But our apartment is beautiful, and it's the first real home that I think I felt in the city, and that's made a huge difference.
Yes.
And just having a sanctuary has made me feel like New York is a little more palatable. And I like New York a lot. I think it's a cool city. Also, I know hundreds of amazing people that live here.
Uh-huh.
So that's something that I'm not going to ignore, but I think we both long for more green, and I think we're both interested in a less saturated scene that maybe needs art a little bit more. However, we both like to be challenged by our communities.
Right.
And you're not going to find that in places that are, that don't have a theater. Or any sort of theater scene, you're not going to find people that challenge you. So we really, it's a back and forth. I think that for the next couple of years, we're definitely going to be here. And depending on how our careers go, we'll see. But I think that's the other thing that's worked for us as an artist couple, is that I don't think that either of us see it as one it has to be this way or it has to be that way. I think that we are recognizing...
Open to possibilities.
Yes.
Yeah, that's good.
Yes, I think we've recognized that things might change quickly or slowly.
Yeah. When you are having a period where you're feeling like you're being drawn to the dark side, you're kind of dealing with a lot of those issues, are there any like concrete things that you reach for again and again? Like mm-hmm. you mentioned the poetry, but are there any books yeah. that you read or music yeah. you listen to?
I do read the Book of Hours, which Rilke wrote. The Book of Hours, he was an atheist, but he has an artist spirit, an artist's spirituality that I think is very universal for anyone. And then I also reach for Pema Chodron,
mm-hmm.
who wrote When Things Fall Apart and Living Beautifully with Uncertainty, I believe is what it's called. But When Things Fall Apart is incredible. You're nodding, so...
Yeah, I... do you know Nick Choksi?
I don't.
He recommended that one to me.
Oh, it's so good.
Me.
It's so yeah. good. Yeah, and then I read... I think that, like, picking up any wonderful fiction, like some Marquez or some Allende or some... I don't know. I'm reading Ava Luna right now, so that's some more Allende. But some, like, I like vibrant, like,
yeah.
really vibrant
fiction. That you can really just get engulfed in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, 100 Years of Solitude is, I mean, The House of Spirits...
Mm.
I read last winter, and music, I go to folk singers. I go to Joan Baez, Bob Dylan, or Joni Mitchell. It's kind of classic.
Nice.
But, yeah.
And then the last thing I wanted to ask was just if you've seen anything recently that you want to recommend. I know you've been out of town, but of any art form.
My friend Adina is going to be in the play Indecent by Paula Vogel that's coming to Broadway in in a couple of months, I guess. And it's a really powerful play, so I would recommend that one. And come see Jib if it comes
to New York. For sure.
Yeah, I'm trying to think if there's anything else. Go see Uncle Vanya.
Yeah, thank you.
I need to go see that one.
Yeah, please come. We need friendly faces. I know, I'm so sorry.
And I also, I listen to, when I go to the dark side, I very much listen to the podcast On Being.
Yeah, that's a great one.
Yeah, I love that one. And I listen to The Moth all the time.
Yeah.
The Moth podcast.
I need to put that one back in my rotation.
Yeah.
Well, Laura, thank you so much, and thank you for being open to doing this again.
Yeah,
in addition to the live episode. And I know that there were things that we talked about in the live episode that we didn't talk about today, but so that's just special for the people who were there. But.
I don't remember what they were. I feel like I was less articulate this time around because I was more relaxed.
No, this is good. It was a nice, calm chat. So yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Compass Podcast. I'm Leah Walsh. More episodes are coming soon. Please look for us on Facebook and iTunes. I'd like to thank the following people for their generosity. The Compass cover art is by Kim Miller, music by Brendan Spieth, audio assistance from Nick Choksi, and a special thanks to Frankie J. Alvarez. See you next time.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.